place. He was found in their domain by people of Orhocharf, which lies northeast of Shaf. They did not know who he was nor where he came from, for they found him crawling in the snow, starving, snowblind, his face blackened by sun and frost, and at first he could not speak. That he took no lasting harm except in his left hand, which was frozen and must be amputated. Some of the people there said this was Gethryn of Shaf, of whom they had heard talk. Others said it could not be, for that Gethryn had gone up on the ice, in the first blizzard of autumn, and was certainly dead. He himself denied that his name was Gethryn. When he was well, he left Orhoch and the storm border, and went into the southern lands, calling himself Enoch. When Enoch was an old man, dwelling in the plains of Rer, he met a man from his own country and asked him, "How fares Shath domain?" The other told him that Shath fared ill. Nothing prospered there, in hearth or tilth, all being blighted with illness. The spring seed frozen in the ground, or the ripe grain rotten, and so it had been for many years. Then Enoch told him, "I am Gethryn of Shaf," and told him how he had gone up on the ice, and what he had met with there. At the end of his tale he said, "Tell them at Shaf that I take back my name and my shadow." Not many days after this, Gethryn took sick and died. The traveller carried his words back to Shaf, and they say that from that time on the domain prospered again, and all went as it should go in field and house and hearth. Chapter 3 The Mad King. I slept late and spent the tail of the morning reading over my own notes on palace etiquette and the observations on Guthenian psychology and manners made by my predecessors, the investigators. I didn't take in what I read, which didn't matter since I knew it by heart, and was reading merely to shut up the interior voice that kept telling me it has all gone wrong. When it would not be shut up, I argued with it, asserting that I could get on without Estravan, perhaps better than with him. After all, my job here was a one-man job. There was only one first mobile. The first news from the Ecumen on any world is spoken by one voice, one man present in the flesh, present and alone. He may be killed, as Pelelga was on 4 Taurus, or locked up with madmen, as were the first 3 mobiles on Gao, one after the other. Yet the practice is kept because it works. One voice, speaking truth, is a greater force than fleets and armies, given time. Plenty of time, but time is the thing that the Ecumen has plenty of. "You don't," said the interior voice, but I reasoned it into silence, and arrived at the palace for my audience with the king at 2nd hour full of calm and resolution. It was all knocked right out of me in the anteroom before I ever saw the king. Palace guards and attendants had showed me to the anteroom, through the long halls and corridors of the king's house. An aide asked me to wait, and left me alone in the high windowless room. There I stood, all decked out for a visit with royalty. I had sold my 4th ruby, the investigators having reported that Guthenians valued the carbon jewels much as Terrans do. I came to winter with a pocketful of gems to pay my way, and spent 1/3 of the proceeds on clothes for the parade yesterday and the audience today. Everything new, very heavy and well made, as clothing is in Karhide. A white knit fur, shirt, grey breeches, the long tabard-like over-tunic, hieb, of blue-green leather. New cap, new gloves, tucked at the proper angle under the loose belt of the hieb. New boots. The assurance of being well-dressed augmented my feeling of calm and resolution. I looked calmly and resolutely about me. Like all the king's house, this room was high, red, old, bare, with a musty chill on the air, as if the drafts blew in not from other rooms but from other centuries. A fire roared in the fireplace, but did no good. Fires in Karhide are to warm the spirit, not the flesh. The mechanical industrial age of invention in Karhide is at least 3,000 years old, and during these 30 centuries They have developed excellent and economical central heating devices using steam, electricity, and other principles, but they do not install them in their houses. Perhaps if they did, they would lose their psychological weatherproofing. Like Arctic birds kept in warm tents, who being released get frostbitten feet. I, however, a tropical bird, was cold. Cold one way outdoors and cold another way indoors, ceaselessly, and more or less thoroughly cold. I walked up and down to warm myself. There was little besides myself and the fire in the long anteroom. A stool and a table on which stood a bowl of finger stones, and an ancient radio of carved wood inlaid with silver and bone, a noble piece of workmanship. It was playing at a whisper, and I turned it a touch louder, hearing the palace bulletin replace the droning chant or lay that was being broadcast. Karheiters do not read much as a rule, and prefer their news and literature heard, not seen. Books and televising devices are less common than radios, and newspapers don't exist. I had missed the morning bulletin on my set at home, and half listened now, my mind elsewhere, until the repetition of the name several times caught my ear at last and stopped my pacing. What was it about Estravan? A proclamation was being reread. Therem Harth Rem Ir Estravan, Lord of Estra, in Kerm, by this order forfeits title of the kingdom and seat in the assemblies of the kingdom, and is commanded to quit the kingdom and all domains of Karhide. If he be not gone out of the kingdom and all domains in 3 days' time, or if in his life he return into the kingdom, he shall be put to death by any man without further judgment. No countryman of Karhide shall suffer Harth Rem Ir Estravan to speak to him, or stay within his house, or on his lands, on pain of imprisonment, nor shall any countryman of Karhide give or lend Harth Rem Ir Estravan money or goods, nor repay any debt owing him, on pain of imprisonment and fine. Let all countrymen of Karhide know and say that the crime for which Harth Rem Ir Estravan is exiled is the crime of treason, he having urged privily and openly in assembly and palace, under pretense of loyal service to the king, that the nation dominion of Karhide cast away its sovereignty, and surrender up its power in order to become an inferior and subject nation in a certain union of peoples, concerning which let all men know and say that no such union does exist, being a device and baseless fiction of certain conspiring traitors who seek to weaken the authority of Karhide in the king, to the profit of the real and present enemies of the land. Utgwirni Tua, 8th hour, in the palace in Erinrang, Agaven Harj. The order was printed and posted on several gates and road posts about the city, and the above is verbatim from one such copy. My first impulse was simple. I cut off the radio as if to stop it from giving evidence against me, and scuttled to the door. There, of course, I stopped. I went back to the table by the fireplace and stood. I was no longer calm or resolute. I wanted to open my case, get out the ansible, and send an advise-slash-urgent through to Hain. I suppressed this impulse also, as it was even sillier than the first. Fortunately, I had no time for more impulses. The double door at the far end of the anteroom was opened, and the aide stood aside for me to pass, announcing me. Genri I. My name is Genli, but Karheiters can't say L, and left me in the Red Hall with King Argaven the 15th. An immense high long room, that red hall of the king's house. Half a mile down to the fireplaces. Half a mile up to the raftered ceiling hung with red, dusty drapes or banners all ragged with the years. The windows are only slits or slots in the thick walls. The lights few, high, and dim. My new boots go ek, 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 ek as I walk down the hall towards the king. A 6 months' journey. Argaven was standing in front of the central and largest fireplace of three, on a low, large dais or platform. A short figure in the reddish gloom, rather pot-bellied, very erect, dark and featureless in silhouette except for the glint of the big seal ring on his thumb. I stopped at the edge of the dais and, as I had been instructed, did and said nothing.
"Come up, Mr. I. Sit down."
I obeyed, taking the right-hand chair by the central hearth. In all this I had been drilled. Haravan did not sit down. He stood 10 feet from me, with the roaring bright flames behind him, and presently said,
"Tell me what you have to tell me, Mr. I. You bear a message, they say."
The face that turned towards me, reddened and cratered by firelight and shadow, was as flat and cruel as the moon. Winter's dull Rufus moon. Argivan was less kingly, less manly than he looked at a distance among his courtiers. His voice was thin, and he held his fierce, lunatic head in an angle of bizarre arrogance. "My lord, what I have to say has gone out of my head. I only just now learned of Lord Estraven's disgrace." Argivan smiled at that, a stretched, staring grin. He laughed shrilly, like an angry woman pretending to be amused.
"Damn him," he said, "the proud, posturing, perjuring traitor. You dined with him last night, eh? And he told you what a powerful fellow he is, and how he runs the king, and how easy you'll find me to deal with since he's been talking to me about you, eh? Is that what he told you, Mr. I?"
I hesitated.
"I'll tell you what he's been saying to me about you, if you've an interest in knowing. He's been advising me to refuse your audience. Keep you hanging about, waiting. Maybe pack you off to Orgorain or the islands. All this half-month he's been telling me, damn his insolence. It's he that got packed off to Orgorain."
Again the shrill false laugh, and he clapped his hands together as he laughed. A silent immediate guard appeared between curtains at the end of the dais. Argivan snarled at him, and he vanished. Still laughing and still snarling, Argivan came up close and stared straight at me. The dark irises of his eyes glowed slightly orange. I was a good deal more afraid of him than I had expected to be. I could see no course to follow among these incoherencies but that of candor. I said, "I can only ask you, sir, whether I am considered to be implicated in Estraven's crime."
"You? Now."
He stared even more closely at me.
"I don't know what the devil you are, Mr. I. A sexual freak or an artificial monster or a visitor from the domains of the void. But you're not a traitor. You've merely been the tool of one. I don't punish tools. They do harm only in the hands of a bad workman. Let me give you some advice."
Argivan said this with curious emphasis and satisfaction, and even then it occurred to me that nobody else in 2 years had ever given me advice. They answered questions, but they never openly gave advice, not even Estraven, at his most helpful. It must have to do with Shifgrethor.
"Let no one else use you, Mr. I," the king was saying. "Keep clear of factions. Tell your own lies, do your own deeds, and trust no one. Do you know that? Trust no one. Damn that lying, cold-blooded traitor. I trusted him. I put the silver chain around his damn neck. I wish I'd hanged him with it. I never trusted him. Never. Don't trust anybody. Let him starve in the cesspits of Mishnori, hunting garbage. Let his bowels rot. Never."
King Argivan shook, choked, caught his breath with a retching sound, and turned his back on me. He kicked at the logs of the great fire till sparks whirled up thick in his face and fell on his hair and his black tunic, and he caught at them with open hands. Not turning around, he spoke in a shrill, painful voice.
"Say what you've got to say, Mr. I."
"May I ask you a question, sir?"
"Yes?"
He swayed from foot to foot as he stood facing the fire. I to address his back. "Do you believe that I am what I say I am?"
"Estraven had the physician send me endless tapes about you, and more from the engineers at the workshops who have your vehicle and so on. They can't all be liars, and they all say you're not human. What then?"
"Then, sir, there are others like me. That is, I'm a representative
of this union, this authority. Yes, very well. What did they send you here for? Is that what you want me to ask?"
Though Argivan might be neither sane nor shrewd, he had had long practice in the evasions and challenges and rhetorical subtleties used in conversation by those whose main aim in life was the achievement and maintenance of the Schiff-Grethar relationship on a high level. Whole areas of that relationship were still blank to me. But I knew something about the competitive, prestige-seeking aspect of it, and about the perpetual conversational duel that can result from it. That I was not dueling with Argivan, but trying to communicate with him, was itself an incommunicable fact. I've made no secret of it, sir. The Ecumen wants an alliance with the nations of Githin.
What for?
Material profit, increase of knowledge, the augmentation of the complexity and intensity of the field of intelligent life, the enrichment of harmony and the greater glory of God. Curiosity, adventure, delight. I was not speaking the tongue spoken by those who rule men, the kings, conquerors, dictators, generals. In that language there was no answer to his question. Sullen and unheeding, Argivan stared at the fire, shifting from foot to foot.
How big is this kingdom out in nowhere, this Ecumen?
There are 83 habitable planets in the ecumenical scope, and on them about 3,000 nations or anthrotypic groups.
3,000? I see. Now tell me why we, one against 3,000, should have anything to do with all these nations of monsters living out in the void.
He turned around now to look at me, for he was still dueling, posing a rhetorical question, almost a joke. But the joke did not go deep. He was, as Estravan had warned me, uneasy, alarmed. 3,000 nations on 83 worlds, sir. But the nearest to Gethin is 17 years' journey in ships that go at near light speed. If you thought that Gethin might be involved in forays and harassments from such neighbors, consider the distance at which they live. Forays are worth no one's trouble across space. I did not speak of war, for a good reason. There's no word for it in Karhaitish. Trade, however, is worthwhile. In ideas and techniques communicated by Ansible, in goods and artifacts sent by manned or unmanned ships. Ambassadors, scholars, and merchants, some of them might come here, some of yours might go off-world. The Ecumen is not a kingdom, but a coordinator, a clearinghouse for trade and knowledge. Without it, communication between the worlds of men would be haphazard, and trade very risky, as you can see. Men's lives are too short to cope with the time jumps between worlds. If there's no network and centrality, no control, no continuity to work through, therefore they become members of the Ecumen. We are all men, you know, sir, all of us. All the worlds of men were settled eons ago from one world, Hain. We vary, but we're all sons of the same hearth. None of this caught the king's curiosity, or gave him any reassurance. I went on a bit, trying to suggest that his Schiff-Grethar or Karhides would be enhanced, not threatened, by the presence of the Ecumen. But it was no good. Argivan stood there sullen as an old she-otter in a cage, swinging back and forth from foot to foot, back and forth, baring his teeth in a grin of pain. I stopped talking.
Are they all black as you?
Githinians are yellow-brown or red-brown, generally. But I had seen a good many as dark as myself.
Some are blacker, I said. We come all colors.
And I opened the case, politely examined by the guards of the palace at four stages of my approach to the Red Hall, that held my ansible and some pictures. The pictures, films, photos, paintings, actives and some cubes, were a little gallery of man. People of Hain, Chifawar, and the Seashans, of Es and Terra and Altera, of the Uttermosts, Capitan, Olul, Four Taurus, Rokanan, Enspo, Sime, Gideh, and Shealshelhaven. The king glanced at a couple without interest.
What's this?
A person from Simir, a female. I had to use the word that Gathenians would apply only to a person in the culminant phase of Kemmer, the alternative being their word for a female animal.
Permanently?
Yes. He dropped the cube and stood, swinging from foot to foot, staring at me or a little past me, the firelight shifting on his face.
They're all like that? Like you?
This was the hurdle I could not lower for them. They must in the end learn to take it in their stride. Yes. Gathenian sexual physiology, so far as we yet know, is unique among human beings.
So all of them, out on these other planets, are in permanent Kemar? A society of perverts. So Lord Tybe put it. I thought he was joking. Well, it may be the fact, but it's a disgusting idea, Mr. I. And I don't see why human beings here on Earth should want or tolerate any dealings with creatures so monstrously different. But then perhaps you're here to tell me I have no choice in the matter.
The choice for Karhide is yours, sir.
And if I send you packing, too?
Why, I'll go. I might try again with another generation. That hit him. He snapped.
Are you immortal?
No, not at all, sir. But the time jumps have their uses. If I left Gethin now, for the nearest world, Holul, I'd spend 17 years of planetary time getting there. Time jumping is a function of traveling nearly as fast as light. If I simply turned around and came back, my few hours spent on the ship would, here, amount to 34 years. And I could start all over. But the idea of time jumping, which, with its false hint of immortality, had fascinated everyone who listened to me, from the Horton Island fisherman on up to the Prime Minister, left him cold. He said, in his shrill, harsh voice,
"What's that?"
Pointing to the Ansible. The Ansible communicator, sir.
Radio?
It doesn't involve radio waves or any form of energy. The principle by which it works, on the concept of simultaneity, is analogous in some ways to gravity. I'd forgotten again that I wasn't talking to Estrafan, who had read every report on me and who listened intently and intelligently to all my explanations, but instead to a bored king. What it does, sir, is produce a message at any two points simultaneously, anywhere. One point has to be fixed on a planet of a certain mass, but the other end is portable. That's this end. I've set the coordinates for the prime world, Hain. An NAFAL ship takes 67 years to go between Gethin and Hain, but if I write a message on that keyboard, it will be received on Hain at the same moment as I write it. Is there any communication you'd care to make with the Stabios on Hain, sir?
I don't speak Voidish, said the king with his dull, malign grin.
They'll have an aide standing ready. I alerted them. Who can handle Karhaitich?
What do you mean? How?
Well, as you know, sir, I'm not the first alien to come to Gethin. I was preceded by a team of investigators who didn't announce their presence but passed as well as they could for Gethinians, and traveled about in Karhide and Orgorain and the archipelago for a year. They left and reported to the councils of the Ecumen over 40 years ago, during your grandfather's reign. Their report was extremely favorable, and so I studied the information they'd gathered and the languages they'd recorded and came. Would you like to see the device working, sir?
I don't like tricks, Mr. I.
It's not a trick, sir. Some of your own scientists have examined—
I'm not a scientist.
You're a sovereign, my lord. Your peers on the prime world of the Ecumen wait for a word from you. He looked at me savagely. In trying to flatter and interest him, I had cornered him in a prestige trap. It was all going wrong.
Very well. Ask your machine there what makes a man a traitor.
I typed out slowly on the keys, which were set to Karhide's characters. King Argaven of Karhide asks the Stabios on Hain what makes a man a traitor. The letters burned across the small screen and faded. Argaven watched, his restless shifting stilled for a minute. There was a pause, a long pause. Somebody 72 light-years away was no doubt feverishly punching demands on the language computer for Karhidish, if not on a philosophy storage computer. At last, the bright letters burned up out of the screen, hung a while, and faded slowly away. To King Argaven of Karhide on Gethin, greetings. I do not know what makes a man a traitor. No man considers himself a traitor. This makes it hard to find out. Respectfully, Spimoli, G.F., for the Stabios, in Sa'ir, on Hain, 93/1491/45. When the tape was recorded, I pulled it out and gave it to Argyvan. He dropped it on the table, walked again to the central fireplace, almost into it, and kicked the flaming logs and beat down the sparks with his hands.
"As useful an answer as I might get from my foreteller. Answers aren't enough, Mr. I. Nor is your box, your machine there. Nor your vehicle, your ship. A bag of tricks and a trickster. You want me to believe you, your tales and messages. But why need I believe or listen? If there are 80,000 worlds full of monsters out there among the stars, what of it? We want nothing from them. We've chosen our way of life and have followed it for a long time. Karhide's on the brink of a new epoch, a great new age. We'll go our own way."
He hesitated as if he had lost the thread of his argument, not his own argument, perhaps, in the first place. If Estravan was no longer the king's ear, somebody else was.
"And if there were anything these Ecumens wanted from us, they wouldn't have sent you alone. It's a joke, a hoax. Aliens would be here by the thousand."
"But it doesn't take 1,000 men to open a door, my lord."
"It might, to keep it open."
"The Ecumen will wait till you open it, sir. It will force nothing on you. I was sent alone and remain here alone, in order to make it impossible for you to fear me."
"Fear you?"
said the king, turning his shadow-scarred face, grinning, speaking loud and high.
"But I do fear you, envoy. I fear those who sent you. I fear liars, and I fear tricksters. And worst, I fear the bitter truth. And so I rule my country well, because only fear rules men. Nothing else works. Nothing else lasts long enough. You are what you say you are, yet you're a joke, a hoax. There's nothing in between the stars but void and terror and darkness. And you come out of all that alone, trying to frighten me, but I am already afraid, and I am the king. Fear is king. Now take your traps and tricks and go. There's no more need saying. I have ordered that you be given the freedom of Karhide."
So, I departed from the royal presence. Ick, 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 all down the long red floor in the red gloom of the hall, until at last the double doors shut me off from him. I had failed. Failed all around. What worried me as I left the king's house and walked through the palace grounds, however, was not my failure, but Estravan's part in it. Why had the king exiled him for advocating the Ecumen's cause, which seemed to be the meaning of the proclamation, if, according to the king himself, he had been doing the opposite? When had he started advising the king to steer clear of me, and why? Why was he exiled and I let go free? Which of them had lied more, and what the devil were they lying for? Estravan to save his skin, I decided. And the king? To save his face. The explanation was neat, but had Estravan in fact ever lied to me? I discovered that I did not know. I was passing the corner red dwelling. The gates of the garden stood open. I glanced in at the sarum trees leaning white above the dark pool, the paths of pink brick lying deserted in the serene gray light of afternoon. A little snow still lay in the shadow of the rocks by the pool. I thought of Estravan waiting for me there, as the snow fell last night, and felt a pang of pure pity for the man whom I had seen in yesterday's parade, sweating and superb under the weight of his panoply and power. A man at the prime of his career, potent and magnificent. Gone now. Down. Done. Running for the border with his death 3 days behind him, and no man speaking to him. The death sentence is rare in Karhide. Life on winter is hard to live, and people there generally leave death to nature or to anger, not to law. I wondered how Estravan, with that sentence driving him, would go. Not in a car, for they were all palace property here. Would a ship or landboat give him passage? Or was he afoot on the road, carrying what he could carry with him? Karhides go afoot, mostly. They have no beasts of burden, no flying vehicles. The weather makes slow going for powered traffic most of the year, and they are not a people who hurry. I imagined the proud man going into exile step by step, a small, trudging figure on the long road west to the gulf. All this went through my mind, and out of it as I passed the gate at the corner red dwelling. And with it went my confused speculations concerning the acts and motives of Estevan and the king. I was done with them. I had failed. What next? I should go to Orgorain, Karhide's neighbor and rival. But once I went there, I might find it hard to return to Karhide, and I had unfinished business here. I had to keep in mind that my entire life could be, and might well be, used in achieving my mission for the Ecumen. No hurry. No need to rush off to Orgorain before I had learned more about Karhide, particularly about the fastnesses. For 2 years I had been answering questions. Now I would ask some. But not in Erinrang. I had finally understood that Estevan had been warning me, and though I might distrust his warning, I could not disregard it. He had been saying, however indirectly, that I should get away from the city and the court. For some reason I thought of Lord Tybe's Tief. The king had given me the freedom of the country. I would avail myself of it. As they say in ecumenical school, when action grows unprofitable, gather information. When information grows unprofitable, sleep. I was not sleepy, yet. I would go east, to the fastnesses, and gather information from the foretellers. Perhaps. Chapter 4. The 19th Day. An East Karhidish story, as told in Gorenhering Hearth, by Tobor Chorhawa, and recorded by G.A., 93/1492. Lord Barosti Renir Aip came to Thangering Fastness and offered 40 barrels and half the year's yield from his orchards as the price of a foretelling, and the price was acceptable. He said his question to the weaver Odrin, and the question was, "On what day shall I die?" The foretellers gathered and went together into the darkness. At the end of darkness, Odrin spoke the answer. "You will die on Odstref, the 19th day of any month." "In what month? In how many years?" cried Barosti. But the bond was broken, and there was no answer. He ran into the circle and took the weaver Odrin by the throat, choking him, and shouted that if he got no further answer, he would break the weaver's neck. Others pulled him off and held him, though he was a strong man. He strained against their hands and cried out, "Give me the answer!" Odrin said, "It is given, and the price paid. Go!" Raging then, Barosti Renir Aip returned to Charufa, the third domain of his family, a poor place in northern Osnoriner, which he had made poorer in getting together the price of a foretelling. He shut himself up in the strong place, in the highest rooms of the hearth tower, and would not come out for friend or foe, for seed-time or harvest, for camer or foray, all that month, and the next, and the next, and 6 months went by, and 10 months went by, and he still kept like a prisoner to his room, waiting. On Anetherhad and Otstreth, the 18th and 19th days of the month, he would not eat any food, nor would he drink, nor would he sleep. His kemering by love and vow was Herbor of the Gagana clan. This Herbor came in the month of Grande to Thangering Fastness and said to the weaver, "I seek a foretelling." "What have you to pay?" Odrin asked, for he saw that the man was poorly dressed and badly shod, and his sledge was old, and everything about him wanted mending. "I will give my life," said Herbor. "Have you nothing else, my lord?" Odrin asked him, speaking now as to a great nobleman. "Nothing else to give?" "I have nothing else," said Herbor. "But I do not know if my life is of any value to you here." "No," said Odrin, "it is of no value to us." Then Herbor fell on his knees, struck down by shame and love, and cried to Odrin, "I beg you to answer my question. It is not for myself."
"For whom, then?" asked the weaver.
"For my lord and Kemmering, Asher Barosti," said the man, and he wept. "He has no love nor joy nor lordship since he came here and got that answer, which was no answer. He will die of it."
"That he will.
"What does a man die of but his death?" said the weaver Odrin. But Hervor's passion moved him, and at length he said, "I will seek the answer of the question you ask, Hervor, and I will ask no price. But bethink you, there is always a price. The asker pays what he has to pay." Then Hervor set Odrin's hands against his own eyes in sign of gratitude, and so the foretelling went forward. The foretellers gathered and went into the darkness. Hervor went among them and asked his question, and the question was, "How long will Ashe Barosti Rem Ir Aip live?" For Hervor thought thus to get the count of days or years, and so set his love's heart at rest with certain knowledge. Then the foretellers moved in the darkness, and at last Odrin cried in great pain, as if he burned in a fire, "Longer than Hervor of Gaganar!" It was not the answer Hervor had hoped, but it was the answer he got. And having a patient heart, he went home, to Charutha with it, through the snows of Grende. He came into the domain and into the strong place, and climbed the tower, and there found his Kemmering Barosti sitting as ever, blank and bleak, by an ash-smothered fire. His arms lying on a table of red stone, his head sunk between his shoulders. "Asha," said Hervor, "I have been to Thangering Fastness, and I have been answered by the foretellers. I asked them how long you would live, and their answer was, Barosti will live longer than Hervor." Barosti looked up at him as slow as if the hinge in his neck had rusted, and said, "Did you ask them when I would die, then?" "I asked how long you would live." "How long? You fool! You had a question of the foretellers and did not ask them when I am to die, what day, month, year, how many days are left to me. You asked how long? Oh, you fool, you staring fool! Longer than you? Yes, longer than you!" Barosti took up the great table of red stone, as if it had been a sheet of tin, and brought it down on Herbor's head. Hervor fell, and the stone lay on him. Barosti stood a while, demented. Then he raised up the stone, and saw that it had crushed Herbor's skull. He set the stone back on its pedestal. He lay down beside the dead man and put his arms about him, as if they were in Kemmer, and all was well. So the people of Charutha found them, when they broke into the tower room at last. Barosti was mad thereafter, and had to be kept under lock, for he would always go looking for Hervor, who he thought was somewhere about the domain. He lived a month thus, and then hanged himself on Odstreth, the 19th day of the month of Faerm. Chapter 5. The Domestication of Hunch. My landlady, a voluble man, arranged my journey into the east. "If a person wants to visit fastnesses, he's got to cross the Cargav, over the mountains into Old Carhide, to Rare, the old king's city. Now I'll tell you, a hearth fellow of mine runs a landboat caravan over the Eskar Pass, and yesterday he was telling me, over a cup of Orsh, that they're going to make their first trip this summer on Gethany Osme. It having been such a warm spring, and the road already clear up to Angohar, and the ploughs will have the pass clear in another couple of days. Now you won't catch me crossing the Cargav. Erinrang for me, and a roof over my head. But Ami Yomeshta, praise to the 900 throne upholders, and blessed be the milk of Meshe, and one can be a Yomeshta anywhere. We're a lot of newcomers, see, for my lord Meshe was born 2,202 years ago, but the old way of the Handara goes back 10,000 years before that. You have to go back to the old land if you're after the old way. Now look here, Mr. I'll have a room in this island for you whenever you come back. But I believe you're a wise man to be going out of Erinrang for a while, for everybody knows that the traitor made a great show of befriending you at the palace. Now with old Tybe as the king's ear, things will go smooth again. Now if you go down to the new port, you'll find my hearthfellow there, and if you tell him I sent you—" And so on. He was, as I said, voluble, and having discovered that I had no shift Grethor, took every chance to give me advice, though even he disguised it with ifs and as ifs. He was the superintendent of my island. I thought of him as my landlady, for he had fat buttocks that wagged as he walked, and a soft, fat face, and a prying, spying, ignoble, kindly nature. He was good to me, and also showed my room while I was out to thrill-seekers for a small fee. See the mysterious envoy's room. He was so feminine in looks and manner that I once asked him how many children he had. He looked glum. He had never borne any. He had, however, sired four. It was one of the little jolts I was always getting. Cultural shock was nothing much compared to the biological shock I suffered as a human male among human beings who were, 5/6 of the time, hermaphroditic neuters. The radio bulletins were full of the doings of the new Prime Minister, Pemir Hard-Ramir-Taib. Much of the news concerned affairs up north, in the Sinoth Valley. Taib evidently was going to press Karhide's claim to that region, precisely the kind of action which, on any other world at this stage of civilization, would lead to war. But on Gethen nothing led to war. Quarrels, murders, feuds, forays, vendettas, assassinations, tortures, and abominations, all these were in their repertory of human accomplishments. But they did not go to war. They lacked, it seemed, the capacity to mobilize. They behaved like animals in that respect, or like women. They did not behave like men or ants. At any rate, they never yet had done so. What I knew of Orgoraine indicated that it had become, over the last 5 or 6 centuries, an increasingly mobilizable society, a real nation-state. The prestige competition, heretofore mostly economic, might force Karhide to emulate its larger neighbor, to become a nation instead of a family quarrel, as Estervan had said, to become, as Estervan had also said, patriotic. If this occurred, the Gathenians might have an excellent chance of achieving the condition of war. I wanted to go to Orgoraine and see if my guesses concerning it were sound, but I wanted to finish up with Karhide first. So I sold another ruby to the scar-faced jeweler in Ing Street, and with no baggage but my money, my ansible, a few instruments, and a change of clothes, set off as a passenger on a trade caravan on the first day of the first month of summer. The landboats left at daybreak from the windswept loading yards of the new port. They drove under the arch and turned east. 20 bulky, quiet-running, barge-like trucks on caterpillar treads, going single file down the deep streets of Erinrang, through the shadows of morning. They carried boxes of lenses, reels of sound tapes, spools of copper and platinum wire, bolts of plant fiber cloth raised and woven in the west fall, chests of dried fish flakes from the gulf, crates of ball bearings and other small machine parts, and 10 truckloads of Orgota Kardik grain, all bound for the Pering storm border, the northeast corner of the land. All shipping on the great continent is by these electric-powered trucks, which go on barges on the rivers and canals where possible. During the deep snow months, slow tractor plows, power sledges, and the erratic ice ships on frozen rivers are the only transport besides skis and man-hauled sledges. During the thaw, no form of transport is reliable, so most freight traffic goes with a rush come summer. The roads, then, are thick with caravans. Traffic is controlled, each vehicle or caravan being required to keep in constant radio touch with checkpoints along the way. It all moves along, however crowded, quite steadily at the rate of 25 miles per hour, Terran. Gathenians could make their vehicles go faster, but they do not. If asked why not, they answer, why? Like asking Terrans why all our vehicles must go so fast, we answer, why not? No disputing tastes. Terrans tend to feel they've got to get ahead, make progress. The people of winter, who always live in the year one, feel that progress is less important than presents. My tastes were Terran, and leaving Erinrang, I was impatient with the methodical pace of the caravan. I wanted to get out and run. I was glad to get clear of those long stone streets overhung with black steep roofs and innumerable towers, that sunless city where all my chances had turned to fear and betrayal. Climbing the Karga foothills, the caravan halted briefly, but often for meals at roadside inns. Along in the afternoon, we got our first full view of the range from a foothill summit. We saw Kostar, which is 4 miles high from foot to crest. The huge slant of its western slope hid the peaks north of it, some of which go up to 30,000 feet. South from Kostar, one peak after another stood out white against a colorless sky. I counted 13, the last an undefined glimmer in the mist of distance in the south. The driver named the 13 for me and told me stories of avalanches and land boats blown off the road by mountain winds and snowplow crews marooned for weeks in inaccessible heights, and so on, in a friendly effort to terrify me. He described having seen the truck ahead of his skid and go over a 1,000-foot precipice. What was remarkable, he said, was the slowness with which it fell. It seemed to take all afternoon floating down into the abyss. And he had been very glad to see it at last vanish, with no sound at all, into a 40-foot snowdrift at the bottom. At third hour we stopped for dinner at a large inn, a grand place with vast roaring fireplaces and vast beam-roofed rooms full of tables loaded with good food, but we did not stay the night. Ours was a sleeper caravan, hurrying, in its Karhaitis fashion, to be the first of the season into the pairing storm country, to skim the cream of the market for its merchant entrepreneurs. The truck batteries were recharged, a new shift of drivers took over, and we went on. One truck of the caravan served as sleeper for drivers only, no beds for passengers. I spent the night in the cold cab on the hard seat, with one break along near midnight for supper at a little inn high in the hills. Karhide is no country for comfort. At dawn I was awake and saw that we had left everything behind except rock and ice and light and the narrow road always going up and up under our treads. I thought, shivering, that there are things that outweigh comfort, unless one is an old woman or a cat. No more inns now among these appalling slopes of snow and granite. At mealtimes, the landboats came silently to a halt, one after the other, on some 30-degree snow-encroached grade, and everybody climbed down from the cabs and gathered about the sleeper, from which bowls of hot soup were served, slabs of dried bread apple and sour beer in mugs. We stood about stamping in the snow, gobbling up food and drink, backs to the bitter wind that was filled with a glittering dust of dry snow, then back into the landboats and on and up. At noon, in the passes of Wehoth, at about 14,000 feet, it was 82 degrees Fahrenheit in the sun and 13 degrees in the shade. The electric engines were so quiet that one could hear avalanches grumble down immense blue slopes on the far side of chasms 20 miles across. Late that afternoon we passed the summit at Eskar, 15,200 feet. Looking up the slope of the southern face of Kostar, on which we had been infinitesimally crawling all day, I saw a queer rock formation a quarter mile or so above the road, a castle-like outcropping. "See the fastness up there," said the driver. "That's a building?" "That's Arakostar fastness. But no one could live up here." "Oh, the old men can. I used to drive in a caravan that brought up their food from Erenrang late in summer. Of course they can't get in or out for 10 or 11 months of the year, but they don't care. There's 7 or 8 indwellers up there." I stared up at the buttresses of rough rock, solitary in the huge solitude of the heights, and I did not believe the driver, but I suspended my disbelief. If any people could survive in such a frozen area, they would be Karhiders. The road descending swung far north and far south, edging along precipices, for the east slope of the Kargav is harsher than the west, falling to the plains in great stair-steps, the raw fault-blocks of the mountains making. At sunset we saw a tiny string of dots creeping through a huge white shadow 7,000 feet below. A landboat caravan that had left Erenrang a day ahead of us. Late the next day we had got down there and were creeping along that same snow slope, very softly, not sneezing lest we bring down the avalanche. From there we saw for a while, away below and beyond us eastward, vague, vast lands blurred with clouds and shadows of clouds and streaked with silver of rivers, the plains of Rer. At dusk of the fourth day out from Erenrang, we came to Rer. Between the two cities lie 1,100 miles and a wall several miles high and 2,000 or 3,000 years. The caravan halted outside the western gate, where it would be shifted onto canal barges. No landboat or car can enter Rer. It was built before car hiders used powered vehicles, and they have been using them for over 20 centuries. There are no streets in Rer. There are covered walks, tunnel-like, which in summer one may walk through or on top of as one pleases. The houses and islands and hearths sit every which way, chaotic, in a profuse, prodigious confusion that suddenly culminates, as anarchy will do in Karhide, in splendor. The great towers of the Un Palace, blood-red, windowless. Built 17 centuries ago, those towers housed the kings of Karhide for 1,000 years, until Argaven Harj, first of his dynasty, crossed the Kargav and settled the great valley of the Westfall. All the buildings of Rer are fantastically massive, deep-founded, weatherproof and waterproof. In winter the wind of the plains may keep the city clear of snow, but when it blizzards and piles up they do not clear the streets, having no streets to clear. They use the stone tunnels or burrow temporary ones in the snow. Nothing of the houses but the roof sticks out above the snow, and the winter doors may be set under the eaves or in the roof itself like dormers. The thaw is the bad time on that plain of many rivers. The tunnels then are storm sewers, and the spaces between buildings become canals or lakes on which the people of Rer boat to their business, fending off small ice floes with the oars. And always, over the dust of summer, the snowy roof jumble of winter, or the floods of spring, the red towers loom, the empty heart of the city, indestructible. I lodged in a dreary, overpriced inn, crouching in the lee of the towers. I got up at dawn after many bad dreams, and paid the extortioner for bed and breakfast, and inaccurate directions as to the way I should take, and set forth afoot to find other hoard, an ancient fastness not far from Rer. I was lost within 50 yards of the inn. But keeping the towers behind me, and the huge white loom of the Kargav on my right, I got out of the city, headed south, and a farmer's child met on the road told me where to turn off for other hoard. I came there at noon. That is, I came somewhere at noon, but I wasn't sure where. It was mainly a forest or a thick wood, but the woods were even more carefully tended than is usual in that country of careful foresters, and the path led along the hillside right in among the trees. After a while I became aware that there was a wooden hut just off the path to my right, and then I noticed a quite large wooden building a little farther off to my left, and from somewhere there came a delicious smell of fresh frying fish. I went slowly along the path, a little uneasy. I didn't know how the Hanarata felt about tourists. I knew very little about them, in fact. The Handara is a religion without institution, without priests, without hierarchy, without vows, without creed. I am still unable to say whether it has a god or not. It is elusive. It is always somewhere else. Its only fixed manifestation is in the fastnesses, retreats, to which people may retire and spend the night or a lifetime. I wouldn't have been pursuing this curiously intangible cult into its secret places at all if I hadn't wanted to answer the question left unanswered by the investigators. What are the foretellers? And what do they actually do? I had been longer in Karhide now than the investigators had, and I doubted that there was anything to the stories of foretellers and their prophecies. Legends of prediction are common throughout the whole household of man. God speaks, spirits speak, computers speak. Oracular ambiguity, or statistical probability, provides loopholes and discrepancies are expunged by faith. However, the legends were worth investigating. I hadn't yet convinced any Karhider of the existence of telepathic communication. They wouldn't believe it till they saw it. My position exactly, regarding the foretellers of the Handara. As I went on along the path, I realized that a whole village or town was scattered about in the shadow of that slanting forest, all as random as Rare was, but secretive, peaceful, rural. Over every roof and path hung the boughs of the hemans, the commonest tree of winter, a stout conifer with thick, pale scarlet needles. Hemon cones littered the branching paths, the wind was scented with hemon pollen, and all the houses were built of the dark hemon wood. I stopped at last, wondering which door to knock at, when a person came sauntering out of the trees and greeted me courteously. "Will you be looking for a dwelling place?" he asked. "I've come with a question for the foretellers. I decided to let them take me at first, anyhow, for a car rider. Like the investigators, I had never had any trouble passing as a native, if I wanted to. Among all the Karhaidish dialects, my accent went unnoticed, and my sexual anomalies were hidden by the heavy clothing. I lacked the fine, thick hair thatch and the downward eyeslant of the typical Gathenian, and was blacker and taller than most, but not beyond the range of normal variation. My beard had been permanently depilated before I left Olol. At that time we didn't yet know about the pelted tribes of Perunter, who are not only bearded but hairy all over like white Terrans. Occasionally I was asked how my nose got broken. I have a flat nose. Gathenian noses are prominent and narrow, with constricted passages well adapted to breathing sub-freezing air. The person on the path at Otherhord looked with mild curiosity at my nose and answered, "Then perhaps you'll want to speak to the weaver. He's down in the glade now, unless he went out with the wood sledge. Or would you rather talk first to one of the celibates?" "I'm not sure. I'm exceedingly ignorant." The young man laughed and bowed. "I am honored," he said. "I've lived here 3 years, but haven't yet acquired enough ignorance to be worth mentioning." He was highly amused, but his manner was gentle, and I managed to recollect enough scraps of Handara lore to realize that I had been boasting, very much as if I'd come up to him and said, "I'm exceedingly handsome." I meant I don't know anything about the foretellers. "Enviable," said the young indweller. "Behold, we must sully the plain snow with footprints in order to get anywhere. May I show you the way to the glade? My name is Goss." It was a first name. "Genri," I said, abandoning my L. I followed Goss farther into the chill shade of the forest. The narrow path changed direction often, winding up the slope and down again. Here and there, near it or away off among the massive trunks of the hemans, stood the small, forest-colored houses. Everything was red and brown, dank, still, fragrant, gloomy. From one of the houses drifted the faint, whistling sweetness of a Karhaidish flute. Goss went light and quick, graceful as a girl, some yards ahead of me. All at once his white shirt blazed out, and I came out after him from shadow into full sunlight on a wide green meadow. 20 feet from us stood a figure, straight, motionless, profiled, the scarlet hib and white shirt an inlay of bright enamel against the green of the high grass. 100 yards beyond him stood another statue, in blue and white. This one never moved or glanced our way all the time we talked with the first one. They were practicing the Handara discipline of presence, which is a kind of trance. The Handarata, given to negatives, call it an untrance, involving self-loss, self-augmentation, through extreme sensual receptiveness and awareness. Though the technique is the exact opposite of most techniques of mysticism, it probably is a mystical discipline tending towards the experience of immanence. But I can't categorize any practice of the Handarata with certainty. Goss spoke to the person in scarlet. As he broke from his intense movelessness and looked at us and came slowly towards us, I felt an awe of him. In that noon sunlight he shone of his own light. He was as tall as I, and slender, with a clear, open, and beautiful face. As his eyes met mine, I was suddenly moved to bespeak him, to try to reach him with the mind-speech I had never used since I landed on Winter, and should not use yet. The impulse was stronger than the restraint. I bespoke him. There was no response. No contact was made. He continued to look straight at me. After a moment he smiled and said, in a soft, rather high voice,
"You're the envoy, aren't you?"
I stammered and said, "Yes."
"My name is Faxa. We're honored to receive you."